Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Two dozen state attorneys general are calling on a bankruptcy court to reject a proposal from Purdue Pharma. Purdue manufactures OxyContin. The deal would settle thousands of lawsuits that stem from the company's role in the deadly opioid epidemic. Purdue has offered to pay more than $4 billion over the next decade. Critics say the plan doesn't go far enough. WBR reporter Martha Biebinger has been following this story. Martha, what is in the proposal?
Lisa, under this proposal, Purdue, the company that makes that addictive painkiller OxyContin, would offer a deal of worth about $10 billion. Now, here are some of the key parts. Members of the Sackler family, who made billions selling that addictive pain medication, would pay $4.3 billion spread over 9 years. A second key piece is a proposal that would turn Purdue, that company that makes OxyContin, into a public trust, independent eventually of the Sacklers. And, you know, as you said, this is an effort to settle more than 3,000 lawsuits by cities and towns, states, and others across the country that go back years.
So who is getting punished here? Who is it, the Sackler family that owns Purdue, or is it Purdue themselves, or both?
This is an effort to hold both the family and the company accountable. The company was largely run by the Sacklers since its inception, but the idea is that the company and the family are intertwined, and both need to be held accountable.
Over the years, Purdue has been sued by nearly every state in the country. Last November, Purdue pleaded guilty to defrauding health agencies and violating anti-kickback laws. The Sackler family individual members have agreed to pay the federal government $225 million in civil penalties. How does this latest deal then fit with all the other lawsuits the company's involved with?
Well, the difference between this proposal and the last one in bankruptcy court is at least $1.3 billion more from the family. There are also some more details in this settlement about how the company would be turned over to a public trust and no longer directly benefit the company or the Sackler family.
Who gets the money that Purdue would put forth through this? Purdue says the proposals would allow additional payments to be spread out over the decade. To whom?
The money would be dispersed, Lisa, in three broad categories. One is to states and municipalities. The other is to individuals or families who lost loved ones. And the third category would be Native American tribes whose individual members, as well as their government entities, have really had enormous expenses due to trying to deal with addictions. So when we look at individuals, there are something like 130,000 people who have filed claims against Purdue, and it looks like they might get around $48,000 a piece, which the advocates say is well short of what they deserve for the suffering and the loss of the lives.
And there are several entities pushing against this. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey is one of the many attorneys general opposing the deal. She spoke to WBUR this morning. Let's hear what she had to say.
It's not enough money. It's also a plan that doesn't provide what our families deserve, which is transparency and accountability.
Could you unpack that a little bit, Martha, and tell us what she and the others are opposed to?
Yes. So Maura Healey is one of 24 attorneys general, including leaders in D.C., who have sued Purdue and who have suggested they'd like to continue to pursue legal action. So this settlement, if approved, would put an end to all of those individual civil cases against Purdue. They could still face criminal charges, but this would stop the civil actions. So as you heard Ms. Healey say there, they don't think this is enough money, and they don't think there's enough accountability for Purdue here. And what they mean there, Lisa, as you suggested unpacking, is that there's some hints at disclosures of things Purdue may have done in the years of managing this addictive drug, OxyContin, that need to come to light. these attorneys think that there will be additional pressure coming to bear in the public over the next few months. And they think that there will be a reason for Purdue to offer more compensation to the states and the individuals and the tribes. They're going to continue to keep fighting until they feel like all of the details have come out so that we have a full picture of what Purdue did to contribute to the opioid epidemic.
And Purdue still needs approval from a federal bankruptcy court for this deal. Martha Biebinger is a reporter for WBUR. Thank you so much, Martha.
Thank you, Lisa.
Mexico is on the cusp of becoming the largest legal marijuana market in the world. Last week, Mexican lawmakers advanced a bill that would legalize the drug for recreational use, and Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is expected to sign it. Some lawmakers hope that it will help neutralize the country's powerful drug cartels. Joining us now is Ryan Berg. He's a research fellow in Latin American studies at the American Enterprise Institute. It's a think tank in Washington, D.C. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me, Peter.
Sure, and I believe this would be the most populous country to legalize the drug. So how big of a step is this for Mexico?
It is a big step. The law would make Mexico the third country to legalize marijuana behind Uruguay, which did it in August of 2014, and Canada, which did it in October of 2018. And it would be the largest market for cannabis in the world at about 120 million people or so.
Hmm. And what do you think is driving that push to do this?
Well, I think that there's been a lot said about how this might help Mexico fight the well-articulated criminal organizations which operate with near impunity in the country. But I'm a little bit more skeptical. I think this has much more to do with domestic reasons, criminal justice reform in specific. According to a recent study, about 40% of inmates in Mexico are serving sentences for possession of drugs, valued at something about less than $25. So marijuana legalization could reduce Mexico's severe prison overcrowding problem. The country has about 17,000 inmates over capacity in recent years, as well as trim the number of nonviolent offenders who come into contact with criminal organizations, which really carry out robust operations within the prisons. It's yet another operating system or a node in their transnational organized crime network. I think the number of prisoners we can reduce having contact with those types of groups, the more we can reduce recruitment from those groups.
So why don't we take a look at this theory that it would help defang the country's powerful drug cartels? You say you're skeptical about that. Why? Because on the surface, you know, it sounds like a good idea. Get rid of the black market and the cartels would suffer.
I think you have to look at where their revenue is emanating from. Less than half of their revenue on a yearly basis is coming from drug trafficking. And within that number, only about 15 to 25% is actually coming from drug export revenues attributed to marijuana. So marijuana is not one of the key drugs that drug trafficking organizations are pushing. In fact, it's the much more highly addictive substances like methamphetamine, obviously synthetics, fentanyl, heroin, things that have a much bigger market price and profit margin. But again, that's less than 50% of criminal organizations' revenue. Take the Knights Templar, for example, a group, a very violent group that operates in Michoacán State in the south of Mexico. The group started out as a major generator and transporter of methamphetamine, but already in the year 2014, its main sources of revenue had nothing to do with drugs. It was involved in mining, in logging, extortion, and all sorts of other illicit businesses. And so criminal groups are fast becoming more like multinational corporations than they are simply drug trafficking organizations.
That's very interesting. What do you think is driving the cartels to diversify into other drugs and to other business opportunities, as you described? Like, what's the reason behind that?
I think they're very in tune with their markets. There's a demand in the United States for different types of drugs, and Mexican cartels, which are some of the main providers of those drugs to U.S. end users, are simply shifting their operations to consumer demand. The other thing is the profit margins that I mentioned, so much bigger for cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and synthetics, not to mention that they're highly addictive, far more likely to trigger habitual users than, say, marijuana. It makes sense for them from a profit-making perspective.
Okay, so your theory is that legalizing marijuana for those reasons would not put much of a dent in the cartel's bottom line. But what position do you think it puts the United States in to now be positioned between two major countries, Canada and Mexico, where recreational marijuana is legal or would be legal. Do you think it'll pressure the Biden administration to do something similar?
I certainly think that it could make marijuana legalization once again circulate in American political conversation. But I do think for the time being, it's probably going to remain a state-by-state issue. One of the other reasons why cartels haven't been relying on marijuana trafficking as much as they have other types of drugs is quite simply the United States, in states where it is legal to produce, produces quite a bit of its own marijuana, in addition to the Canadian marijuana that you mentioned. And so there's a lot of competition. But for the time being, I anticipate that this is going to be a state-by-state discussion because the national agenda of the Biden administration seems to be far more focused on pandemic and pandemic recovery, infrastructure, and some of the other things that we've heard about Democrats in Washington pushing in the Senate and the House.
Ryan Berg, research fellow in Latin American studies at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Ryan, thank you very much.
Peter, it's been a pleasure.
In Jackson, Mississippi, more than 70% of residents still have to boil their water before they use it. This, even though it's been nearly a month since a winter storm shut down the city's water system. Some residents didn't even have running water until last week. Now most do, but it's still not safe to drink from the tap. This water crisis has been a long time coming. Notices to boil water are common in the city, where the majority of residents are Black. A disappearing tax base has left Jackson with a crumbling infrastructure that's nearly a century old. Jackson Public Works Director Charles Williams is on the front lines of this crisis. Charles, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Could you describe what the water situation is like in Jackson right now? How many people still don't have safe drinking water almost a month out from the storm?
Well, right now, all 43,000 connections on the surface water side are still on a boil water notice. And that will not be lifted until the city has 2 good days of sampling that is turned into the Mississippi Department of Health.
What is the problem with the drinking water? What is the contamination that's keeping people from being able to drink out of the tap?
Well, it's precautionary. Right now, until we meet the compliance standard as it relates to water quality, making sure there's not any bacteria or pathogens that is in the water. And so once the samples come back good, then we can start lifting the boil water notice throughout the city.
Jackson's mayor, Chukwuma Lumumba, is asking Mississippi's governor, Tate Reeves, for $47 million to help repair the water system. As you know, you're an engineer. I wonder if you think that's going to be enough to modernize the system so people in Jackson can actually count on having clean water.
No, ma'am. That is not what we consider the panacea. You know, we're also looking at other funding opportunities, you know, so we can make sustainable repairs moving forward.
If the $47 million that's being asked of the governor is not going to be enough, and I know you're asking for more money from the EPA and other sources, why is there not a commitment to get the people of Jackson clean water? I mean, at this point, it's an aging system. You have a tax base that has really been crumbling. So is there a lack of commitment? Is it not seen as a priority?
I can't necessarily speak to the political side of it, but what I can tell you is that obviously we have had repetitive occurrences as relates to water outages for, you know, almost 20 years. And you can point to the lack of investment in the water and wastewater infrastructure in Jackson. So we realize that the request that is made to the governor obviously is not going to solve all of our problems, but it's a start.
What have you heard from members of the business community? For instance, who is it impacting most?
The one thing that we've been getting is how much more can our residents and business community take? You know, we have 1 year, we have been dealing with COVID. We also had a 30-year flood and now, you know, a major water outage. And so it's a lot. It's a lot from an economic standpoint. You know, when you've already lost a lot of revenue for our business community and for our residents who are struggling, you know, during this time.
I just want to ask you how you, I mean, it's been almost a month now this has been happening. You sound very calm, but I wonder how you keep managing and pushing against the system which seems as though it is going to take an awful lot to rectify.
Well, what we try to look at is how can we do better? We want to make sure that we seize this opportunity right now that the focus is on Jackson. The focus is on our infrastructures. There should be no more excuses. Now is it's the time to invest, because it's going to happen again. So I want to make sure that we are a lot better shape than we were before this particular event and basically collapsed, you know, our treatment facilities and our inability to provide water to our citizens.
That's Public Works Director Charles Williams in Jackson, Mississippi, where residents are still having to boil water after storms battered the region almost a month ago. We wish you the best of luck, Charles. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hunger is on the rise in many parts of the world thanks to the pandemic. So it's surprising to see this new report by the United Nations that says at least 17% of the world's food supply goes to waste. That's about a billion tons of food ending up in the trash bin every year. Most of it comes from households. Richard Swanell is director of RAP Global. It's an international sustainability group. He co-authored the report with the UN. Welcome.
Good to be here, Peter. Good to be here.
And good to have you. And can you start by telling us why we are wasting so much food?
Well, this is a really intriguing question. First of all, it's worthwhile being clear about what this refers to. The food waste we're talking about today is in the homes. It's in retail and hospitality sectors. And the bulk, as you've said, is in the household. We do know that it's a global problem affecting most households. So from the three or four countries that have actually done detailed analysis of the causes of food waste, it comes down to basically people actually not buying what they need, buying too much, and the food going off before it goes away, not storing it in the right places, and therefore it goes off before it needs to, not understanding date labels, and confusion about date labels is actually causing people to throw food away, not getting portion sizes right, so that's leading to leftovers, and then not being confident to use those leftovers, and therefore those leftovers get thrown away rather than used for another meal.
I see. Now, when you say the labels, you're referring to, I believe, when, you know, a carton of milk, for instance, might say something like best if used by date, and then we just throw it away if we get to that date and maybe we shouldn't?
Correct. Best before or best if used before, that type of thing, is actually a label associated with quality. And therefore, it is best before, but it's fine afterwards. For most products, they're labeled with that. And then there's one that's usually referred to as a use-by date. That's usually a food safety issue. You can actually freeze up to the use-by date, and therefore you can actually therefore use the freezer as your friend to preserving that food for a later date.
You studied this around the world. So tell me, who are the worst offenders? Are we talking rich countries, poor countries? Does it matter?
Well, that was one of the most astonishing things about doing work on this report, Peter, because we were expecting there to be differences. But for the countries where we had data, and that was 54 countries in total, representing somewhere around 75% of the world's population, there was no difference between the food waste in wealthier countries and the food waste in middle-income countries. You know, really? The average is about 74 kilograms per person per year, which is more than the average body weight of a human.
Well, that is staggering. Beyond the fact that so many people are very hungry across the globe, that's one thing. But this also has environmental implications, doesn't it?
It does. It absolutely huge environmental implications. And just to give you an idea, if you look at the food loss and waste from farm all the way through to fork and then on to the disposal route, maybe landfill or incineration, and you look at the greenhouse gas emissions across that whole supply chain, food loss and waste is responsible for between 8 and 10% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. Mm. If food loss and waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet behind China and the US.
So is it a matter then of individuals making different choices of, you know, composting their food scraps one by one, or does it require something like large-scale government policy change in order to make this difference?
It's really interesting because at the heart of this is how we behave in our own homes. And one of the reasons why we don't actually take much action to reduce food waste is that we don't see it. When the UK started work in this particular space, 9 out of 10 people in the UK said they didn't waste food. And yet, actually, when you looked at it, you know, we're wasting about 80 kilos per person per year. In terms of interventions that make a difference, behaviour change campaigns supported by retailers and food manufacturers can actually help citizens drive change, as long as they're focused on the behaviours that we know result in food waste. So, for example, the Love Food, Hate Waste campaign in the UK has been running for over 10 years and has helped citizens of the UK reduce their food waste, their edible food waste, by 31%, which shows that these interventions work.
Well, what are those interventions?
You're highlighting through a range of channels to get the message across to people. First of all, the size of the prize. The average UK family wastes about $1,100 worth of food every single year. And then you focus on those behaviours, which fundamentally are buy what you need and eat what you buy. For example, before going shopping, take a selfie, i.e. take a photograph with your phone of your inside of your fridge or your inside of your cupboard. And that way you know exactly what you've got, and therefore you won't duplicate it. Store your fruit and veg in the best possible places. So apples will last up to 2 weeks longer if you pop them in the fridge, but potatoes are best in the dark. And think about the portion sizes, and if you do have leftovers, keep them. The freezer is your friend.
Does composting negate the environmental impact?
Composting actually has a modest effect, Peter, on reducing the overall greenhouse gas emissions. It's a good thing to do because, you know, you're taking food waste and you're converting it into fertilizer product, which can actually be used on land effectively, and that's great. But wasting food feeds climate change. If you want to do something about it, prevent it in the first place. That'll save you the most money, but it'll also have the biggest impact on the environment.
Richard Swanell, director of RAP Global, an international nonprofit that focuses on sustainability, out with a new report along with the United Nations, saying essentially that we are all wasting quite a bit of food every single year. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Hearing loss is a fact of life for many humans, but not for fish, reptiles, or birds.
People noticed in chickens that they could take them to, say, heavy metal concert, blast the ears really to oblivion, and then within days, new hair cells would begin to sprout.
The science of sound. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Hi!
Introducing South by Southwest Online. A digital experience.
A massive music, film, and ideas conference South by Southwest gets underway today in Austin, Texas. But as you heard, this year it's all online. Last year, South by Southwest was canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic for the first time in its 34-year history. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, let's get to the price of a ticket first. Festival organizers are saying that since you don't have to book plane tickets or hotel rooms in Austin to attend South by Southwest this year, it's more accessible to people than ever. But the rub is that, say, if you register today, it'll cost you $399. Isn't that a lot of money for a Zoom fest?
It is, and it's on the South by organizers to drive home the value proposition. $400 is less than a quarter of the all-inclusive lanyard price, Lisa, we've seen pre-COVID. You are saving on travel and carbon. And yes, everyone at home is eager for connection and new content. And critically, this is an important dress rehearsal for events businesses that are in the future going to have to become hybrid of in-person and online, especially with virtual reality, which South by Southwest is really hitting.
So you mean a lot of other businesses are going to be watching this to see how it goes, to see what they can charge, how they can do things online in years to come?
It's certainly a proving ground. It's right up there. Yeah.
And so what do festival goers get access to for a mere $400?
Pete Buttigieg, Willie Nelson, Stacey Abrams. You can take extended reality tours of of downtown Austin, you know, Congress Avenue in the Red River Cultural District. I saw that actor Nick Offerman is going to be participating in a celebration of Wisconsin cheese. So, yeah, grab your popcorn.
But you can't even have any unless you go out and buy it at the grocery store. And the performers and speakers, are they going to be performing and speaking from Austin or elsewhere?
It's all over the place. You have some people in Austin, Texas is much more lax than other places. Some people are coming in remotely. In some cases, the whole point of the technology is to showcase the fact that you don't have to be in one place. We can connect someone in Switzerland and in Albany and make it look like they're all here with us. So it is, and you're getting licensed to innovate that in this second consecutive kind of virtual experience.
So this is usually an opportunity, the Fest is, for brands to sponsor different parts of the festival. Is that happening this year?
In a more muted way, and there's an emphasis on showcasing tech bells and whistles. So the gold standard, yes, it's clearly hosting a tent or a venue with celebs and their social media followings in full attendance. That's important to ad agencies. It's important for networking. But barring that, you're seeing the likes of HBO and CNN trying to make the best of it using virtual reality, FedExing special care packages to influencers and crossing their fingers.
And so there's an opportunity, of course, here, and that is for people overseas who want to watch the Fest, because typically only one in four attendees comes from overseas, and also for overseas acts who sometimes have trouble getting through customs to come to the festival. Could this help South by Southwest find a new audience?
Innovation mothers necessity, right? Look, Lisa, I'm a huge LA Dodgers fan. If I didn't live 2,600 miles away from Dodger Stadium, I'd be at every home game having hot dogs with Magic Johnson. But even if I did live in LA, it'd be hard to brave all the congestion several times a week. Now think about fans across the country and the world who are offered, like South by Southwest, an a la carte or season pass premium virtual reality option. That would, on balance, sell more tickets to a capacity-constrained opportunity. So every live events business is pondering what's going to be happening at South by.
Robin Farzad, Radio's Full Disclosure. You're listening to Here and Now.
Refrain from causing a stink. That's a warning to the Biden administration delivered by the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Kim Yo-jong's public statement is North Korea's first directed at the new American president. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Peter.
And I want to read a little bit more of this statement from Kim Jong-un's sister. It said, "We take this opportunity to warn the new U.S. administration, trying hard to give off gunpowder smell in our land. If it wants to sleep in peace for coming 4 years, it had better refrain from causing a stink at its first step." Jim, what do you think? Why now? Why are we hearing this?
Well, first, I went back and I read the full text of the statement. And when you read it, you really have to admire North Korea's sheer devotion to two things, and you captured part of it: taunting and tortured metaphors. Right. It is far more fun to read a North Korean statement than the equivalent U.S. statement. But you asked why this is happening. I think there are two events that are related to the timing of the statement. First, the U.S. and South Korea are conducting a scaled-down version of war games, which is they traditionally do some war gaming each March. That was affected by President Trump's agreement with the North Korean leader about suspending.
Is that the is that the reference to the gunpowder smell, do you think?
Yeah, yes, but also it is reference to the second event that's happening this week in the region, and that is that the Biden National Security Team, their Secretary of Defense and their Secretary of State, are both in the region, both in Northeast Asia, for talks with allies in Seoul, in Tokyo. And of course, a major topic of conversation is going to be North Korea. So I think it's both those things.
Sure. And what do you think the significance of hearing from Kim Jong-un's sister is, and not himself, not Kim himself?
Well, yeah. Well, we saw this. The story of various members of the court is often one of, you know, ascent and decline and ascent and decline. So we have the sister who is a blood heir to the founder of South Korea, Kim Il-sung, and probably the most powerful family member that is not Kim, the ruling Kim. And she seemed to gain prominence, you'll remember, in the Tokyo Olympics, seemed to be gaining steam, people talking about her as a potential successor. And then after the failed summit in Hanoi, she seemed to have taken a hit, and we didn't see a lot of her. She's back, and she's basically speaking in the name of the chairman, which no one else other than her is really allowed to do. So I would say it's a sign that she's back.
Yeah. The White House yesterday, Press Secretary Jen Psaki confirmed that the Biden administration did, in fact, reach out recently to North Korea. Let's listen.
Diplomacy is always our goal. Our goal is to reduce the risk of escalation.
She also went on to say that the administration hasn't yet heard back from North Korea. So first of all, Jim, let's get into that. Your thoughts on the wisdoms of opening talks with North Korea?
Well, I think you have to talk to people. It's more important to talk to your enemies than your friends, because you don't want them going off doing something stupid. But what you put your finger on, Peter, something very important. What is not in her message? So what's not in the message? She's not really, for that one reference to the president, she's not attacking, North Korea is not attacking the U.S. administration. It's not till the final couple of paragraphs that they even mention the U.S., and they don't mention Biden by name. No, instead, she focuses on the South Korean president and says all these terrible things about him. But it's a little like a losing basketball team. You can't fire the players, so you fire the coach. And North Korea wants to hold off on criticizing the new U.S. president, so it aims its fire instead at South Korea. I mean, in general, what I take away from this is really more restraint than anything else. I think they're being careful.
And maybe that's a good thing. But what is a realistic goal for any talks that could theoretically happen with the Biden White House? And I ask that because, of course, President Trump made a point to go out of his way to court Kim Jong-un. Not much came of it, and Kim doesn't want to give up his weapons.
Well, I think we're both, yes, but I also, I mean, it's the difference between what you want and what you need. So I'm sure Kim would like to hold on to all his weapons all the time and build more, but he is facing COVID, economic problems, sanctions, international isolation, and in his big New Year's Day speech, apologized for the poor performance of the economy. So I think that's why this is a little restrained. I mean, the worst threat they make in that statement is they might close a diplomatic office, which isn't exactly a nuclear test in my book. So I think we're in the in-between here. Both sides are sort of circling each other, trying to figure out what to do. Both can hurt each other. Neither wants to be hurt right now. And so we have a little bit of war games, but not much. And we have a little bit of criticism, but not much. But the curious thing is, as you point out, something only insiders know, North Korea has refused to negotiate. They've refused to talk ever since the failed Hanoi summit. So Biden would like to talk to them, even if just to make things a little more stable, but they aren't answering the phone. So we're in for a period of sort of betwixt and between, warily taking steps towards and away from each other over this next period of time, I think.
Jim Walsh, always enlightening to talk to you about North Korea. Here at Now Security Analyst, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Detroit, a majority black city, just over one resident in every 10 has gotten at least the first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. As we'll hear from Kate Wells of Michigan Radio in a report that first aired on Morning Edition, the city is now asking some of its biggest black churches to serve as vaccination sites.
At Fellowship Chapel in Northwest Detroit, the pastor is keeping the mood light.
Did you see my lollipops over there?
No, I didn't see the lollipops.
Give me the lollipop, too. So from the bitter to the sweet.
Reverend Dr. Wendell Anthony has been pastor here for 34 years. He has seen what COVID has cost this church. He's lost family members, close friends. He's presided over their funerals. But every weekend, for over a month now, his church has become a vaccination clinic for seniors. One of them, a woman in a wheelchair, asked the pastor, "Can you guys do more campaigning to get people to come here?
Because so many of us are not taking a shot, to encourage them to come out and take the shot."
I was just talking to her about that.
Yeah.
We are doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we put it on videos. We have flyers.
So far, just 13% of Detroiters have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine. That is one of the lowest rates in the entire state. It's about half as much as the neighboring suburban counties. And Reverend Anthony knows that hesitancy around the vaccine is real. It's one of the reasons he wants to do these clinics here, so people can ask him, "Did you get your vaccine?"
"Yeah, I did. And it didn't hurt."
Ada Strong was hesitant at first.
Because when I used to take the flu shot, I would get very, very sick.
What convinced her was hearing from people who have gotten the shot and were fine. Now, the vaccine doesn't feel as scary as COVID itself.
Because you know what? I would hate to have it and be lying in bed and couldn't breathe. I couldn't imagine that. You know what I mean?
But she still hasn't been able to convince her adult son to get it, even though he has chronic lung disease.
But he said, Mom, I don't want to take it. I said, but I don't understand. You're going to die if you don't take it, guy. And he said, Mom, I don't want it.
Hesitancy isn't the only obstacle. Just getting access to the vaccine is a major issue. The Detroit Health Department has turned the convention center downtown into a mass vaccination site. But that is 12 miles from this neighborhood, or an hour and 15-minute bus ride. And many of the vaccines allocated to Detroit have gone to hospitals and big health systems. Mayor Mike Duggan says that doesn't help Black Detroiters, who are less likely to have primary care physicians or ties to the big hospitals.
Just because you send vaccines to a hospital in a poor community doesn't mean the neighbors are the ones who get into the hospital. And that's why this type of community outreach is so important.
But the city's outreach to churches so far is limited to just 5 churches one day a week. The health department is also doing some mobile events targeted at teachers, auto workers, and nursing homes. Overall, the city has given out more than 100,000 doses. But people who work in Detroit are eligible too. And those non-residents have gotten nearly 40% of the city health department's doses. That means about 60% of the shots have gone to actual Detroiters. Earlier this week, the mayor announced that they are planning to open a second mass vaccination site in the northwest part of the city. That's the same neighborhood as Fellowship Chapel. Reverend Anthony says here they have done about 2,000 vaccinations, and they've got more demand than they can handle.
We overflow, and there just needs to be more of this.
For NPR News, I'm Kate Wells in Detroit.
From Texas to North Carolina, from Memphis to St. Louis, barbecue is a big deal in the USA. Well, today we're dropping into Kansas City. Henry Perry had his place there. He was the so-called barbecue king. Perry was born on this day 147 years ago. From member station KCUR, Mackenzie Martin brings us the story of the Black entrepreneur who in the early 1900s created an American institution.
One of the first things you should know about Henry Perry is that he didn't get the name Barbecue King posthumously. He called himself the Barbecue King. He put it in newspaper ads. It was on the window of his restaurant. Perry also didn't create barbecue in Kansas City. People were already barbecuing meat when he arrived in 1907 from Memphis. He was just the first guy to really make a living selling it, and he coined the local style. To many, the reason for his success was pretty simple.
He smoked barbecue better than anybody. And they traveled from as far as Leavenworth, Kansas, just to eat his food.
In spite of it being the Jim Crow era, Kansas City historians like Sonny Gibson say Perry's various restaurants in the Black neighborhood surrounding 18th and Vine attracted a diverse customer base.
You could walk in through the front door, you would see Black and white people. It was a place where segregation ended when you walked through the door.
It's not like barbecue was the great unifier, but like jazz at the time, Perry's was a place where Black and white people coexisted in ways they weren't doing elsewhere. According to Perry, there was only one way to cook barbecue, slow, over a fire made from hickory and oak wood, with the meat juices dripping on the coals. But while Perry was picky about how he barbecued, he wasn't picky about what he barbecued.
He barbecued and he cooked everything. Raccoons, coons, rabbits.
Possum, hog, mutton. Based on what we know, though, we can safely assume that all of it was pretty tasty, right?
Aren't you a little curious what it would taste like?
No. I'm not curious. No way. Ain't nobody gonna eat no barbecue. raccoon?
Well, there's at least one person.
I've eaten coon before. It has a real pleasant taste, coon does.
Jim Watts is the ombudsman at the Black Archives of Mid-America Research Center here in Kansas City. He credits Perry's marketing and business savvy with what got people to come from all over.
Perry was the guy that stood up, wanted to make a living doing something that he liked doing. He was a businessman.
And Perry's influence didn't end when he died in 1940. In a sense, his influence tripled. See, there were three notable apprentices that Henry Perry taught about barbecue: Arthur Pinkard and brothers Arthur and Charlie Bryant. Pinkard went on to cook for what is now the Gates Family Barbecue chain. Meanwhile, the Bryant brothers, first Charlie, then Arthur, went on to create the business we know today as Arthur Bryant's. They all credited Henry Perry with teaching them everything they knew about slow-cooking meat. But in spite of helping kickstart two of Kansas City's most famous barbecue restaurants, very few Kansas Cityans know the story of Henry Perry. That includes his own descendants.
I am Bernetta McKendra, and I am the granddaughter of Henry Perry.
McKendra never met her grandfather, and she didn't grow up hearing stories about him from her mother or her grandmother.
He just wasn't talked about. He was just known that he was the barbecue king.
Then a few years ago, McKendra happened to overhear someone talking about how Henry Perry had been inducted into the American Royal Barbecue Hall of Fame. It spurred her to start researching the grandfather she never knew.
And it was not until I started to read and got older and saw other publications that I began to know that, oh, I think he really is someone.
McKendra says last summer was when it really sunk in that her grandfather was someone special. That's when Henry Perry Day was proclaimed in Kansas City, exactly a century after he fed 1,000 Kansas Cityans for free on the lawn next to his restaurant.
It was a glorious time. It was really a time of reckoning that not only was this man being recognized, but he also was my blood relative. The thing that's been most interesting to me is his tenacity. What was the drive that kept him going?
Today, there isn't a Perry's Barbecue in downtown Kansas City, but there's Gates and Arthur Bryant's in the old 18th and Vine Jazz District. And not far away, there's Joe's, Jones, LC's, Jack Stack, Q39, and countless others. Kansas City barbecue joints, some of which might not be around today if it wasn't for Henry Perry. And while they might not cook the meat directly on the coals like Perry did, they're still carrying on his tradition of barbecue excellence in Kansas City. For Here and Now, I'm Mackenzie Martin.
Mackenzie's story comes from the podcast A People's History of Kansas City. For more, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here.